Welcome to Crime Wire, a program dedicated to bringing attention to unsolved crimes and educating the public about various types of crimes and how to avoid becoming a victim. If you'd like to submit a case to Crime Wire or suggest a topic for a future show, please email us at thenewcrimewire@gmail.com. You can also like us on Facebook at The New Crime Wire. My name is Denny. My co-host, Delilah Jones, and I are joined by Cheryl Pearson Cuccio, her husband Rob, and author Morgan St. James, Incest, Murder, and a Miracle. The story tells what really happened to Cheryl and Rob before, during, and after Cheryl Pearson, a 16-year-old sexually, physically, and mentally abused teen, paid a classmate $1,000 to kill her father in 1986. As a traumatized teenager, Cheryl only gave one short media interview 30 years ago. However, the murder drew extensive local and national media attention. Some accounts implied that she lied about the abuse, others that she did it for her father's insurance. But Cheryl remained silent for years, too young and destroyed to fight back or discuss the true dark nature of the nightmare she lived. After her release from jail, she and her high school boyfriend, Rob Cuccio, were married. They had two daughters and led as normal a life as possible. Most friends and neighbors had no idea of her past. Cheryl and Rob's gripping story has an additional element, a miracle. On Cheryl's 43rd birthday, May 14th, 2012, after months of misdiagnosed chest pain and other symptoms, Rob, her husband of 25 years, suffered a fatal heart attack. Doctors pronounced him dead, and after 30 minutes, but he'd saved Cheryl's life so many times, even when she wanted to commit suicide, she knew she had to do whatever she could to save him and couldn't live without him. She refused to accept that he was dead because something inside told her he was clinging to a remnant of life. She begged doctors to keep trying and wouldn't give up. The doctor finally said, "We'll try for 10 minutes more, but after that, you'll have to let him go." Then she prayed to everyone she could think of, even to the father she paid to have killed. With only 2 minutes of the 10 minutes left, 43 minutes after his heart ceased to beat and supply oxygen to his brain, there was a faint pulse and Rob came back to life. The doctors never had a case where the patient was dead for so long and did not sustain massive brain damage. It was indeed a miracle. Cheryl, Rob, and Morgan, welcome to Crime Wire.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hey, Denny.
Thank you, Denny. Good to be back on with you again.
Yes, it's been a while, Morgan. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Cheryl, I'd like to begin with you telling our listeners what your home life was like prior to the incident in 1986. What was your family makeup? And how did your father treat the others?
Okay. I was a teenager back then who had to cook and clean and take care of my family because at that point in my life, my mother was very sick. She had a very rare disease that affected her kidneys, and she wasn't home. So I had a mom and a dad, and like I said, my mom was sick. I had an older brother who was 3 years older than me, and I had a younger sister who was 8 years younger than me. So I was a middle child, and like I said, I did all the duties that a housewife and a mom would do when my mom was sick. She was in the hospital, away from the home, most of the time from when I was 10 years old on. And my father was described as very vulgar, more as a bully. People were afraid of him. He was my brother's little league coach. And just to get an idea, he was thrown off out of the little league as being the coach just for cursing out his own players on his own team. He was thrown out of the league. So you know, that kind of just gives you a little bit of an insight of what type of man he was.
Now, was he physically abusive to your brother or sister or your mom?
You know, to my brother, he was very much so, very physically and mentally and verbally abusive to my brother. My brother stopped playing sports altogether, would very much be physically abusive to my brother to the point where my brother would pass out from my father physically hitting him often. My mother, you know, to be honest with you, I don't remember my father physically hitting my mother, but he was verbally abusive to her. And my little sister, not so much. Never, you know, she was very little when my mother first got sick, so she wasn't really, you know, when she was an infant, she was my father wasn't around too much. She went to work and then spent a lot of time, you know, either at the hospital or my sister was, you know, at our neighbor's house in the evening and stuff like that. So he didn't really spend too much time with her as far as, you know, physically abusing her, but didn't hit her. You know, I was pretty much protecting her at that point. So, but just basically the only ones that really suffered the abuse as far as physically and mentally and verbally abusive was me and my brother, and then unfortunately the sexual abuse was just myself.
Now, the sexual abuse, do you remember about how old you were when that began?
The fondling started when I was 10 years old.
10, so...
Right, when my mother became sick and left the house to go into the hospital. That's when it started.
So this went on for several years then, right?
It was 6 years.
6 years.
Yes.
Was your father ever turned into an agency, a government agency, you know, child protective type thing? And did anybody outside the family know what was going on and make a complaint or no?
No, I'm afraid not. You know, it was, you know, I never realized until I was at my hearing that people even suspected anything. There was approximately 20 people that testified that they had thought something was going on, but then as adults were too afraid to come forward themselves. They were afraid of him and what might happen if they confronted him themselves. So me as a child, people have said, why didn't I come forward? But yet 20 grown adults who did not live with him didn't go forward and go the right avenues. And yet people as, you know, as me as a child living in the environment expected me who, you know, was threatened on a daily basis and was brainwashed that nobody would believe me was at that point was supposed to have gone forward and tell somebody. And, you know, something like that, as far as incest, you're taught to, you know, have a mindset that, you know, I didn't trust anybody here, somebody that I was supposed to have trust and, you know, is your father and you're supposed to trust your parents. And, you know, my mother wasn't in the house and I was supposed to have trust my father and he was breaking my trust by doing this. So how was I supposed to trust somebody else to help me? And here this person was violating my trust and threatening to kill me if I told and brainwashing me that nobody would believe me anyways and that he was doing this incest relationship because he loves me. That is a big reason why I did not go to anybody and tell. And then I had adults reported that they thought something was going on, but they didn't go forward themselves. So, you know, that's the whole big thing about incest. It's a dirty secret.
Yes, and it's like you say, there was 20 some adults that suspected, yet they didn't do anything. It seems like in a lot of these types of cases, it's always easier to blame the victim.
Yes, everybody you know, until you walk in someone's shoes and you just don't, you just don't know. You know, it's just, you just don't know how you would react in the circumstances until you're in that, you know, spot.
Now, Charlotte, so this is going on, we're in 1986 now.
Mm-hmm.
This has been going on for 6 years, the sexual piece of it. Did something happen, or was there any particular incident or event or concern that you had that convinced you it was time to do something, that something had to be done?
Well, you know what, Denny, there was a couple of different things, to be honest with you. You know, like I said before, first, you know, I was, you know, brainwashed that, you know, nobody would believe me. And then second, you know, he was threatening me, you know, constantly that if I did tell, that, you know, he would kill me. And I believed him. You know, he was a very scary man. He was, you know, a large man, you know, 6 foot, you know, 200-300 pounds. And I was scared, you know, beat me on a regular basis. And then, you know, he started showing signs, you know, same signs that, you know, he started showing the same signs of how, you know, the incest relationship started with me. Started showing the same signs on my sister. And then, you know, with his smirks, you know, with his smirk saying, you know, this is what I'm going to be doing to your sister if you keep leaving the house. So that was on my mind constantly. I needed to protect her. And then I felt like, you know, that I was disappointing my mother. I felt like she was watching from heaven, and I was disappointing her by allowing my father, you know, to rape me several times a day. That was weighing heavy on my mind, you know. She was gone for a year, and while she was in heaven, that's what she was doing. She, you know, was watching over, and, you know, at the funeral, that's all everybody kept saying was, "Oh, your mother will protect you and watch you from heaven," and that's what I thought she was watching. And then finally, like the last straw was that, you know, Rob realized what was going on, you know, in my house between me and my father. And then I had that pressure of him, somebody finally knew what was going on, because he spent so much time, you know, in my house, and he finally realized what was going on. And then that one night that I was sitting at my house, you know, listening to the news, and I heard that the Beverly Wallace case came on the news, and I heard the story that she had hired somebody to, you know, kill her abusive, you know, husband. And then that weighed on my mind. And after all those things, you know, are on my mind between, you know, protecting my sister and my mother watching from heaven, and then, you know, Rob knowing about the abuse that somebody knew, and I didn't want him to think that, you know, I was allowing it to happen either. And just all the pressure and all the, you know, everything on my head, I just needed it to stop, and I felt like there was no way out.
Cheryl, before we bring Rob in, I got one more question I'd like you to answer. You now come to the conclusion that your father's death is really the only way to end this situation you and your sister and brother find yourselves in. How did it come about with this classmate? Did you just ask him if he, or please explain how this, you got talking with him about it, and how you reached the accommodation that he would do the job?
Okay, so like I said, I heard the Beverly Wallace on the news, and it was weighing heavily on my mind that night. And so when I went into homeroom, you know, the next day, it was the kid in front of me, his name was Sean Peeker, and his last name is P-I-C, and I sat behind him, and my last name was P-I-E. And so, you know, I just started up a conversation with him, and I just said, you know, "Hey, did you hear about the Beverly Wallace case on the news last night?" And he turned around and said no, and I continued to tell him about the story, about it was this lady from Mastic, which is, you know, in the area by where we live. And I said, you know, she hired someone to kill her husband because, you know, she was being abused. And he said he didn't hear about it. And I said, "Yeah, wow, who would be crazy enough, you know, to kill someone for money?" And he, you know, he was like, "I would if the money was right." And I just took a minute, and I'm like, "Well, how much would you do it for?" And he said, $1,000, and then I just waited for a minute, and I was thinking to myself, $1,000? That's all you would do it for? And I was like, wow. I'm like, you know, thinking to myself, that's not a lot of money. And then I was like, you know, you would do it for $1,000? And he's like, yep. And I'm like, I whispered to him, you know, would you do it for me? And he's like, yeah. And that's how the whole thing got started. And so from there, you know, he said he would do it. And, you know, I told Rob, you know, a couple days later when I spoke to Rob, because, you know, back in the day we didn't have cell phones or whatever, and I had to wait until I saw him. And, you know, I thought I would tell Rob, like, I had a good plan now, because, you know, Rob was so upset and worked up that, you know, that he knew what was going on, and I thought I had figured it out and had a good plan, and that's how it got started, and that's how it all began, you know, So I never really thought about the consequences. I just thought about it ending, and that I was protecting my sister, and that it seemed like a good plan at the time, and never really thought it through, and yeah, that's what happened.
Cheryl, from the time you first talked to your classmate until he actually killed your father, about how much time elapsed? Was it a week or two, or was it longer than that?
Oh, it was 3 months. 3 months.
And did you ever have second thoughts during that period? Did you ever get cold feet, so to speak, and think about canceling?
He tried to do it like a month later, and it was a failed attempt, because I believe he was going to, we had a house across the street that my father rented out, and I believe he set the alarm off, and he was, I think the failed attempt, he was going to try to stab my father or something like that, and when it was a failed attempt, Rob found out that he was going to try to stab my father, and I remember Rob flipping out saying, you, because Sean was a very small person, and Rob was like, you are going to stab somebody that's triple your size? Are you out of your mind? He's like, forget it. We'll figure something out. Don't do it, you know, and basically told him, never mind, and we left it at that and never talked about it again, and 2 months went by, and never talked about it, never expected him to do it, and left it at that. We were going to try to figure something out, or just, I don't, you know, it was like a, you know, a dead plan, or, and didn't realize that he did it, you know. And then the day my father was killed, I thought my father had fallen and slipped on the ice. That's what I was told, and never thought that Sean had did it until the cops started questioning me, and never realized that he was shot until they told me he was shot, and then I realized that Sean had did it. So, never realized he had even shot him until later on that day.
So you were actually surprised when it actually took place.
I definitely was surprised, because I didn't realize that he actually did it.
Rob, you were dating Cheryl prior to her father's death. You apparently, you know, had been to the house and so forth. You at some point kind of caught on to what was happening. Have I got that right?
Yes, absolutely. That is correct.
And what was your thoughts? Did you have any thoughts about the best way for Cheryl to get out of this mess that she was in, or did she discuss with you her idea about the classmate and all that, or how did that work out?
Yes. Well, you know, during the year leading up to her father's death, I had gotten to know Cheryl and her family quite well, because I spent almost every night at her house, because she wasn't allowed to go out. And the few occasions that we did go out, I found out later that when Cheryl came home, she found her sister in a compromising situation with her father, and that also made Cheryl not want to go out. So if I wanted to spend time with Cheryl, I needed to spend time with her at her house. And while I was there, well, in the beginning, me and her father got along quite well. Her brother, Jimmy, who was a year older than me, had moved out of the house, and that left Cheryl to not only do the household chores, but also to do some of the manly chores of washing the car and mowing the lawn. And I started to come by and do them for her. I would mow her lawn for her, and, you know, if she needed to wash the father's car, I would wash it for her. And I actually think that her father respected me for that, because, of course, I didn't ask for any money or didn't want anything. You know, I just wanted to help. So in the beginning, we actually got along quite well. But the more I spent, the more time I spent there, and the more he showed me how possessive he was, I kind of got a feeling that something wasn't right. And I don't know how long it was after that that me and Cheryl were having an argument, and it kind of just slipped out of my mouth that I know what your father's doing to you. And when I brought it up to her, she got white as a ghost and said, "You're wrong." I said, "No, Cheryl, I'm not wrong." I said, "I figured this out. I could see the way he looks at you, the way he touches you, the way he always wants you sitting on his lap when I'm around." And so I could tell what's going on. And then finally, she confided in me and said, "You're right. However, you can't tell anybody, because he'll kill me and start on my sister." So, you know, like we wrote in the book, suspecting it was one thing, but actually knowing it was a complete different animal. So at this point, I told her, "Let's get in the car and go. I'm 17, you're 16. I got a good car. I got some money. Let's just leave, you know." And she wouldn't leave her sister. I said, "Well, I can't take an 8-year-old girl with me." I said, "So I'm telling you that I would rather just put you in the car and go." excuse me. So that plan wasn't going to work because of her little sister. So then she told me about this plan that she had, that she was going to have a 16-year-old classmate kill her father, and I told her she was off her rocker. I said, "Shaq, come on. Never." And I believe that I think I must have convinced her that that it wasn't going to happen. And then came that fateful day in February where I got the phone call that her father was dead. And later on that day, when I found out that the kid actually went through with the plan, I knew we were in a whole lot of trouble. I really, like I said, you know, I had hoped we would get away with it, but you're talking about 16-year-old kids, and I knew we were in a lot of trouble.
Now, as the police investigated this, when they realized they had a murder on their hands, did they bring you in for questioning? I know they obviously questioned Cheryl.
Yes.
They talked to you as well?
They brought me in before Cheryl. And what happened was they brought me to headquarters and they marched me past Cheryl's brother to show me that they already had him in headquarters. And me and Jimmy both made eye contact with each other, that's Cheryl's brother. And then they put me into another room and started to interrogate me. I'd say it was probably about, I don't know, a half hour of them doing their browbeating, where they told me I was the shooter. And I said, "No, you got it wrong. I ain't the shooter." And, you know, they again began to get loud and get in my face. And they said, "Well, prove to me that you didn't do it." "Well, because I paid the guy who did it." And they sat down, and I said, "Well, wait a second. You have to understand the reason why. This man was raping and beating his daughter on a daily basis. It wasn't because we didn't like him or we wanted his money. He was raping his daughter." So at that point, they I guess, knew they had the case solved, and they asked me if I would do them a favor and go and pick up Cheryl with them. And they said it would be easier on Cheryl if she saw me. So they put me in the back of the car, and they didn't handcuff me or anything. I still wasn't handcuffed at this point. And they drove me to Cheryl's house, and they woke Cheryl up. It was sometime after midnight, and they asked Cheryl if she had something she wanted to say, and Cheryl still denied that she had anything to do with it until I said, "Sure, they know everything." And then she gave me a look, and I knew she was mad because she had asked me not to tell anybody. However, you know, it's the old thing, the truth will set you free, but first it's going to make you miserable. And,
yes.
you know, and in the car, you know, going there, going to headquarters before they split us up again, I could feel that she was mad that I told her secret, but it needed to come out. So she didn't tell the police. Cheryl didn't tell anybody about the abuse. If anything, I was the one that told her, and then I was the one that told the police. It wasn't Cheryl that told.
Okay, I don't want to give away too much more of your story at this point, and I do want to move on, Rob, to the miracle. Delilah, do you have any questions about this portion of the story before we get into Rob's heart attack?
No, I just wanted, I guess you did say you were about 16, 17 years old, and this had been going on for 6 to 8 years or something like that. You know, I just can't fathom the pressure that you were under, not only with everything you had to handle in your family, but with the incest as well. It's just, it's incredible amount of pressure. And I don't think a lot of people out there totally get it. They totally, you know, a lot of times don't understand what is not only happening to a person physically, but also mentally. And
well, thank you.
I mean,
thank you very much. Because people like would see me in school, and like, I hear from people now that I went to school with, and a lot of them will say, oh, you know, they don't believe me because you seem so normal in school, but they don't understand that school was my only outlet, and that was where I could be a normal kid. And you learn to, like, turn, like, you learn to, you know, live a lie and, like, be different people because you don't have a choice, and you learn you're living a lie so you could, like, push it all in and just try to just pretend to be someone different, because that's what gets you through each and every day. And so I would go to school and try to, you know, fit in and not let anybody know what's going on, because if God forbid I let my secret out and they took me out of the home, then I wouldn't be able to protect my sister. So it was a lot of pressure. And, you know, I did what I had to do. And if I didn't get good grades, I would get beaten. So it was the pressure of getting good grades and keeping my secret and going home and still taking care of all of the house and my sister and my father's needs and being the peacekeeper to make sure that I did everything he wanted me to do so that he didn't go and beat everybody else. And no one seems to understand, like you said, how much pressure and stress it was, and then not be able to tell anybody, you know.
That's incredible.
You know, or talk,
I mean,
about it.
Right. So. It really is. It's just incredible that what you've had to endure.
You know, Cheryl, I was just thinking, as you were talking about the pressure and the stress and so on, that had it not been for your sister and your desire to protect her, you could have very well ended up a suicide.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that, Denny, because I have a lot of people that I, you know, speak to on a daily basis, you know, that reach out to me. And I had just been talking to somebody today about that. And you know, and that's what she had said to me. And I said, you know what, if it wasn't for my sister, I definitely would have been a statistic. One, because I wanted to be with my mother so bad. And I definitely would have done that, to be with her. But I couldn't leave my sister, so that was not an option. And, you know, so, and me and my sister have had our problems over that, because I've always said to her that, you know, we'd get into our fights, and, you know, she, in the very beginning, when she came to live with me when she was 15, she would say, "You ruined my life." And I said, "Oh, yeah? Well, you ruined my life, because if it wasn't for you, I wouldn't have had to go through as many years as I did, because I would have just been a statistic, and I could have, you know, been killed myself, and it would have been over. I wouldn't have had to live through all that." And still, you know, now that as an adult, not only it didn't just end after I got out of jail, I've lived through all these years of pain. It just doesn't end because he's dead or because I got released from jail. It's been a lifetime of pain from him, and nightmares and trust issues and stuff like that. It just doesn't end because, you know, he's dead. That's what people doesn't seem to understand. And so it could have very well been a statistic if it wasn't for her. So, but, you know, that was my main goal, was to protect her. And I still protect her to this day. And I still, you know, now, you know, worry about her. And I promised my mother, and I've always kept that promise, and I will continue to. And, you know, I've been reading up on incest, and, you know, the statistics for, you know, incest with, as far as, you know, teenage suicide is very high. You know, I don't have the numbers in front of me off the top of my head, but I've been reading so many, you know, and it is very high. And it's, you know, it's very scary. Very scary, you know, how many cases are reported just from that. And a lot of kids that commit teenage suicide, or even adults that commit suicide, will commit suicide, and we don't even know how many commit because of it, it's ever happened to them, because they even take that secret to the grave.
Yeah, it's really a very sad, tragic circumstances that these young people, kids, often find themselves in. Rob, let's jump ahead to talk about your heart attack. Prior to that happening, did you consider yourself a religious man?
Well, I was raised Catholic, and I was confirmed, baptized, communion, and confirmed, and I do believe in God. I've been to church a couple of times, but I wouldn't consider myself a religious man by no stretch of the imagination, no.
Okay, so you believed, but you weren't, let's say, 100% into it.
Correct. Like we wrote in the book, I'm no holy roller, you know.
Okay.
Right, yes, but I do, yes, I do believe, I do, yes.
Okay. Now, again, I refer to this as the miracle. Did when that happened and you came out of it, when you were starting your recovery process, did you realize what had happened? I mean, had it sunk in yet, how close you were to death and actually had died?
Yes, you know, now I do believe in the afterlife, because I feel I've actually seen or been a part of it, and my relationship with God has changed. I still don't go to church on a regular basis, although I do think about it more, so I'm hoping that counts for something, because I would like to go, but I do talk to God more, and I'm trying to, I guess, figure out why, out of the millions of people who die, he let me come back. And, you know, like I said, I do believe that it's to go forward with Cheryl and trying to help abuse people. I do believe that is the main reason why he decided to spare my life and let me continue going on without the brain damage and everything else that came with not breathing for almost an hour.
I didn't intend to ask this, but I can't help myself. During the time that you were out of it, unconscious, dead, if you will, did you see or hear anything?
You know, it's odd because I do get that a lot. And, you know, the journey that I took, you know, I'll be honest with you, Denny, it's weird because it comes to me and goes. I did go to a place that was absolutely gorgeous, and very serene and very calm, but I never crossed the threshold into where that place was. I feel like I got right to the threshold and tried to go, you know, tried to take my step in there, and my angel or whoever it was that was with me on my journey stopped me from going any further. And, you know, I do believe that if I had taken that final step, that I wouldn't be here today. So, is it the truth? So many people have made up such stories about being dead that I don't even bring it up too much in the book because, you know, it's what I experienced, and I don't read anybody else's stuff. And if someone's talking about it on TV, I change the channel because I don't want to hear what their experience was because I don't want it to skew mine. So, it was pretty unbelievable. I will say that.
Now I understand too that you now celebrate two birthdays: your original birthday, and then May 14th, so the day you died and came back to life.
Yes, my wife has made that a tradition now, and you know the ironic part again, which is why I think that we were supposed to write this book to help as many people as we could, was that there's 365 days in a year, and the good Lord chose my wife's birthday for me to die on and be dead for 43 minutes on her 43rd birthday and then come back.
He just didn't want to give me a gift, Denny, that's all. He just didn't want to buy me a gift.
Yeah.
That's all.
You know, I mean,
he's trying to get out of getting me a gift. I'm still waiting for one.
I say to her, I say the next year, I'm like, I don't know how I can top the gift of dying and coming back. I mean, I don't know what I'm supposed to do this year. You know?
I said, for every day in intensive care, I should have gotten a diamond, what I went through.
So we do have cake for Cheryl on her birthday, and there's always on the bottom of the cake, it's Roth's rebirthday.
Roth's going to be 5 this year.
Yeah, so this year I'm going to be 5.
Yeah.
Yes.
What a way to keep
young,
huh?
Some people will do anything to hang on to their youth.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, for real, Morgan, you know that. It's
can't have anything myself.
Before we bring Morgan in, I got one final question for Cheryl, for you and Rob both. Either one of you can answer it, or both of you. Why did you decide that this was the right time to write your story?
Okay. I guess I'll answer that one. Well, we've been wanting to, you know, tell our story for a long time now, but I never knew if I was strong enough, to be honest with you, Denny. And, you know, so I've always wanted to, and you know, the story that has been out about me for all these years back when I was a kid was never the right story. They had written a book and a movie about our story that didn't have any of our input, and so we've always, you know, wanted to get our story out there, but I never knew if I was strong enough to bring everything back up, and I didn't know that I was strong enough until. Unfortunately, I didn't have a choice that for the first time I had to speak up for myself, and that was when Rob had his heart attack, and he was unable to be there and speak up with me and for me. And, you know, at that point, you know, when I had to ask the doctor for more time and beg him to, you know, give him 10 more minutes, you know, it was for the first time in my life where you know, he wasn't by my, you know, by my side to take over and protect me like he has, you know, since he's known me for, since I've been 15. So I really had to make a lot of, you know, decisions without him, even though I wanted to wake him up and say, come on, help me with this decision, you know, and then you can go back to sleep. That wasn't an option. Or when I waited for him to, like, run through the emergency doors and save me like he has done my whole life, he wasn't able to do that. So I had to, you know, stand up for myself and stand up for him and make decisions and, you know, life-threatening decisions and fire doctors and hire other ones and make decisions. And after thank God, he pulled through and we were given a second chance to tell our story because, you know, my whole life he saved me and then I was lucky enough to save him that, you know, together, you know, it was a full circle that now we were able to save each other and write the book and write it together and lucky enough to find Morgan and have Morgan tell our story accurately and so the three of us could tell the story and get it out there and hopefully, you know, help other people know that they're not alone and get our story out there correctly and that, you know, incest doesn't have to define you and that, you know, that all these years that I was probably strong enough, but I didn't know it until I had to know it and that's what really made us decide that it was time to, you know, get the true story out there and let people know that this is the story of our lives and not the other story. And you know, just because something bad happened to you in your life, it doesn't mean that you're damaged goods. And that, like I said, it doesn't have to define you. And you could, you know, raise good kids and be a good person and live a good life. And that's basically why we wrote the book, to make it an inspirational book, you know, and let people know that there is light at the end of the tunnel.
Well, Cheryl, I must say that, you know, the circumstances that you found yourself in, both when you were 16 and also with Rob's medical problem, you did what had to be done, and I certainly... respect you for that. You're quite a lady.
Yeah, she always does.
Thank you very much.
She always does.
Okay. Now, let's talk to my old friend and co-author, Morgan St. James. Morgan, before I start with a question for you, I understand regarding the book that there have been some developments. That just a People magazine article has just come out, and also there's been a TV episode.
Yeah, well, actually, April 14th issue of People magazine has a story entitled The Cheerleader and the Hitman, and it is an interview with Cheryl and some input with Rob. And I got to tell you, Denny, it was almost like having a baby. I mean, it took 9 months from the time the project was green-lighted until we actually held the magazine in our hands. And the story in People pretty much tells about the past. It doesn't go into what happened afterwards very much. And, you know, some of the questions you've asked today are things that a lot of people haven't heard. And also, Discovery ID Channel, Lee Beckett, the producer, became a very strong ally of ours and of Cheryl and Rob's. And they are actually not in one episode, but in two episodes of the Eyewitness series, the debut of that new series and the finale. And in the finale, it is both Rob and Cheryl. And we owe a lot of thanks to Lee for as much as she has done for us. And, of course, since the People magazine article came out, there's been a lot of other interest, and we're sort of sorting through all of the requests now. And we're happy to be on your show as one of the first that we're talking to after all the publicity came out.
Well, that's great news to get that kind of interest from the media. Question, Morgan, is how did you become acquainted with Cheryl and Rob, And what was there about their story when you heard it that convinced you you wanted to be involved with the project?
Well, you're being a little coy there, Denny, because you're the one that introduced me to Cheryl and Rob. I don't know if you remember that.
I do remember, but I didn't want to insert myself.
Well, I just inserted you. Put honorable tab A into slot B. Cheryl and Rob had contacted a local editor in their area, Joanne DeSimone, and Joanne felt there was something worthwhile in the project, and she contacted you because she knew you. Well, at the time, as I recall, you were tied up with several projects and weren't able to take it on. And since we had written a book with an abuse victim before, La Bella Mafia, and we worked very well together to keep Bella Capo's voice and tell her story, you asked me if I would be interested in working with Cheryl and Rob, if they were okay with it. And you told me a little bit about the story. And the interesting thing that's happened with me, I mean, we've worked with a couple of other people, too, where the project did not wind up getting published under our names. And the interesting thing was I have felt such an affinity for women who have gone through this horrendous experience that I almost
Morgan,
felt like it was my calling.
You're seen to be cutting out. Is anybody else?
Oh goodness. Am I back in again?
I can hear you better. Go ahead.
Okay. So I almost felt like I needed to help these people tell their story and to make sure that it stayed in their voice, not the voice of somebody who was helping them write it. And so the more I knew about their story, the more convinced I was that I wanted to work with it. Are you there?
Yes. And I was...
Okay. Did I shock you?
Yes. And,
knocked you off your feet, Denny Griffin.
You know, now, Cheryl and Rob's story is very well documented. And as an author, how much easier was it to write this book with the documentation compared to other projects you've been involved with that may not have had the backup that this story has?
Well, I would say that this was up at the upper end of being easier from a technical aspect, because Cheryl had journaled for quite a few years while all these things were happening. And so we had great points of reference on everything. And the real challenge, actually there were two challenges with this book. The first challenge was to get everything into a chronological order where we didn't have to have too many flashbacks, because flashbacks can take the reader out of the story, but yet in some instances it was really necessary for it to be a flashback. And the other thing was integrating two genres, which was the true crime and then the story about Rob's death. And that was rather difficult, and we worked together to integrate it so that we could tie the incidents together and show that it was the progression that Cheryl went through that gave her the strength to deal with this new slam that came at them in their lives. And as far as working as a team, these are some of the most amazing people I've ever met. I mean, I feel like they're my kids. Unfortunately, I'm old enough for them to be my kids. But... hey, I'm okay. I admit it. I can't hide the white hair. Well, I could, but I don't. And, as the story unfolded, we got into more and more things that weren't in the journal, things that really needed to be brought forward in order to give you a sense of the awful things that this couple endured, and yet after 30 years they're as much in love with each other as they were when they met. Could have broken several couples apart. I mean, this is one of the amazing parts of the story that I don't know how many people realize what they endured together.
Thank you, Morgan.
Yes,
my pleasure. My pleasure.
And
you need acknowledgement, both of
and
you.
And we also do feel that you're part of our family now as well.
Yes.
You know, after
okay,
going
kid.
Through this that we went through.
Well, you know, isn't it interesting that my own daughter and Cheryl were both born in the same year in the month of May?
Right, yeah. It is. There's so many things like that in the story that it's really crazy.
Yeah, I mean, you two girls are only 2 weeks apart.
Hmm.
What a coincidence, huh?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you know, Denny, but the other coincidence is, I mean, I think that I was meant to work with these people because this is the one instance, and then when you and I worked on Bella Capo's book, she and my daughter were both born on May 31st.
Yeah,
somebody up
right.
there is telling me something.
You have a lot of kids. That's what it's telling you.
we're starting to get a little short on time. I want to make sure before we run out that, Morgan, what formats is the book available in and where can it be purchased?
Okay, the book is available in paperback and in all forms of digital. And, of course, it can be found on Amazon. It's on Barnes & Noble. It's on Kobo. It's on Scribd. It's on Apple. It's on various places. And if people go to our website, which is www, and then the title of the book, incestmurderandamiracle.com, there are links to all the different sites that are the most likely places to purchase the book. However, it is available at almost every online bookseller, and you can go into any Barnes & Noble or independent bookstore, give the title, and say that you'd like to order it.
Okay, great. Delilah, do you have any questions remaining before we wrap up?
Well, I just think, like Morgan said, this is kind of a divine intervention story as it all unfolds. You know, the miracles that both of these people have survived and coming together with you to tell the story. And I can't wait to get a copy of the book.
I guarantee you. You'll be turning the pages, Delilah.
Okay.
Yeah, we're hoping a lot of people read it just because we really feel like it's inspiring and it gives all kinds of people hope, even Rob Zan, who's unfortunately battling cancer. You know, you don't have to be an incest survivor or any kind of abuse victim. It just gave her, she said, I feel like if you guys went through everything reading this book, everything that you went through in this book, I feel like I could fight cancer. That's how inspired she felt after reading it, because it just, even if it gave her one more day of hope, that after everything she read in the book that we went through, you know, so if it just gives somebody a smile on their face and feels inspired for one day, that's all we want. We just want people to feel like, you know what, if we could do it, they could do it too. And that's just what we want them to put a smile on their face. That's all.
Okay,
Denny, do we have time for one more thing? A quick one? Something that we haven't mentioned is that Rob is an oncology nurse, and three years after he died, and there is evidence of the fact that he was dead for 43 minutes, he was named Nurse of the Year New York 2015. Now, isn't that something?
That's amazing.
He's always been a caretaker, always for the underdog, always taking care of people. You know, he is just. He's amazing. All his patients love him. And, he's just always taking care of, always the underdog, including his wife. So.
Well, you're going to be the Uber dog now.
You know, for real. Thank you, guys. Thank you.
Unfortunately, we're going to have to close it out here. Cheryl, Rob, and Morgan, thank you so much for being here and sharing what's a truly fascinating story. And I wish you all the success in the world with that book. And
thank you so much.
Thank
you for giving us the platform.
Time,
we appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for telling us story.
Thank you so much for having us on your show, Denny.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.
Morgan, you there?
Kevin, for the grand prize of $1 million. What color is the White House?
I know this.
5 seconds.
Oh, switching to Geico could save you a bunch of money on car insurance?
Okay. Judges? That's true, Kevin. They'll allow it. Congratulations. You're a winner.
Woo! Geico, because saving 15% or more on car insurance is always a great answer.